MacCast, Monday, August 13th, 2012. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, I hope you are doing well. I'm doing pretty good, although things are still busy here in MacCast headquarters. Always a lot of stuff going on. Of course, lots of Apple news and rumors going on. Some crazy events over the past week or so with a little bit of hacking and security concerns. We're going to get into those in this episode. We're also going to answer a bunch of your questions. A lot of you asking questions about media devices and storage. Of course, we've got some mountain lion feedback and questions and things to get into as well. So I think it's going to be a really good, fun episode. I'm glad you're here hanging out with me. But before we get into everything, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that's Apollon. They make an application called Pimp Your Screen. It's available on the App Store. They also have a Mac App Store version available. But in essence, what it does is it allows you to quickly and easily add cool customized desktops to your iOS devices. And you can set up desktops for your lock screen and your home screen through the application. What's great is that their designs are all done by their own in-house artists, and they update them very frequently, and you'll get the updates automatically through the app. So once you've made the purchase, they're pushing out constantly new backgrounds. And they'll do cool things like when seasons roll around or different holidays and stuff like that, they'll push out some updates, and so you get some new backgrounds that you can play around with. And that would be cool in and of itself, but then they layer on some additional functionality to help you further customize and really make your backgrounds unique. You can do things like add shelves. You can add little effects behind your icons, so you can give them little edge effects like glows and drop shadows or extra edges and stuff like that, make them a little more 3D and kind of blend into your background. So they almost become a part of the entire background. And you can play around with all this stuff because they have what's called the lock screen and the home screen maker. So you can just browse through sort of some of the standard ones, and they all mix and match different ones for different kinds of cool effects. But you can also do that for yourself. So you can go in and you can choose backgrounds that go behind your lock screen. You can choose effects that go behind your icons. You can choose different style shelves that layer on top of your background. So you can really mix and match and make it completely custom. And you don't have to go into what we would typically have to do, like an application on our desktop, like Photoshop or something like that, and create all that. You do it all inside the app. And you can just quickly play around with them. They even have an icon preview button so you can see what your icons are going to look like once you've saved it out and put them into place. And then it's really easy to save that background, set it up as your home screen or your lock screen. And just recently, they added a bunch of new categories that you can browse into the application. So they now have abstract, cartoon, holidays, and sci-fi images. And there's even additional categories that are accessible through nominal in-app purchase. So if you're the type of person that really likes to customize your device, you like to personalize it and give it your own spin, I think this is really an app you should check out. It's on the App Store. Again, there's also a Mac version available if you want to check that out. It's called Pimp Your Screen from Apollon, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. Very likely many of you, if not all of you, have now heard about the Honan hack that happened over the past week. Reporter for Wired magazine, Matt Honan, had his accounts hacked, actually multiple accounts hacked, including his iCloud account, and had some pretty devastating ramifications happen. Basically, they went in, and at one point, the hackers completely remotely wiped his iOS devices in his Mac, and he lost data. It was a pretty big story, made a lot of headlines around the blogosphere, and I wanted to comment on it a little bit, just give you a little bit of my take and my spin, because really, I think what gets lost is a lot of people want to point to any one source, specifically Apple. There was a lot of emphasis and focus thrust upon Apple as being a big problem in this security issue. But I think it was a little bit more complex than that. And I was hoping to point out to at least the MacCast audience sort of what was going on. You know, the hackers here used numerous holes in the password and account security policies in multiple locations and with multiple companies to actually gain access to this guy's account. And according to most of the reports I was reading, the ultimate goal was to gain access to his Twitter account. He had a really short Twitter name, @Matt, @MAT, and apparently that's what they wanted to get access to. But in the path to get there, they made this long, winding trail of destruction and data loss in their wake. And so to distill it down really as quickly as I possibly can, it went like this. So they wanted to get access to his Twitter profile, so they kind of started there. And within his profile, they found a link to his personal website. From his personal website, they were able to find out that he had a Gmail address. And so at that point, they decided, well, if we can get into his Gmail account, we can possibly gain access to the Twitter account. And the theory, I think, was that most of us link our accounts together. So you might have registered for your Twitter account with your Gmail password. And so you can get in through other services, you know, in sort of leap from one service to another. So that was kind of the strategy they were taking here. So they needed access to his Gmail account, and they went to Gmail's password recovery page. And this is where the first breakdown of sort of information, and this is not necessarily a technology problem, you know, this is more of a policy problem. And that's what I kind of want to point out along the line here, is that each one of these companies, starting with Google, had sort of these policy issues, right? And so on the password recovery page, they offer up an alternate email address in case you can't get in and you can't get to your Gmail account. They'll send your password to another email, and you set that up in your settings. But on that page, to help you out, be helpful, Google displays a partial version of your email address. And in this case, it was pretty obvious that this was Matt's .mac account or MobileMe account address and @Mac email. And they used that to then figure out, well, we can go after some of the information that Apple has. And if we can get access to the iCloud account, then we can do a password reset. It'll come from Gmail to the iCloud account, and then we can get in. Well, when they looked at what they needed for .Mac or for iCloud, they needed to know certain bits of information. They needed to have a street address. They needed to have his email address, which they already had at this point. And they needed the last four digits of the credit card he had on file with Apple. And they were able to get the address information from doing a simple whois search on his domain name. So they had been to his website, knew his domain name, did a whois search, and he had not registered for the domain privacy. So the address associated with that registration was there. I think it's important to point out that that information could have been garnered very easily through also a white pages search or some other mechanism. So it's not necessarily 100% that not having a private registration would have exposed this information, but it would have helped protect that information a little bit further. So with that in hand, they had the missing piece was the credit card number. And so they thought, well, Amazon would have the last four of the credit card number. That's something they show in your order receipts. So if we can get into the Amazon account, then we can work our way backwards. And so now they started thinking about, well, where are the holes in Amazon's policies and security? And it turned out that you could call up Amazon, and if you had your name, your email address, and a billing address that were valid, they would add a credit card to your account. You could just add the credit card over the phone. And so all you needed was a technically valid credit card, not necessarily a working one, but if you had the right number scheme for, say, a Visa, you could get that added to the Amazon account. So that's what they did. They called up a representative. They had a card added to the account. And then the other hole in Amazon's policies was that with the full credit card number on an account, you could get them to, over the phone, reset your password. And so now that they had inserted this fake credit card number into his account, they called Amazon support back up, gave them the credit card number, and asked them to reset the password. And then it was just a cascading thing down from there. They got into the Amazon account. They looked at the order receipt. They were able to see the last four digits of his credit card. They called up now AppleCare support or iCloud support, asked for a password reset. They said, well, what's the last four of your credit card? They had that information. So Apple then reset that password. And at that point, they were into his .Mac account. They could issue the password reset from Google. That went to .Mac, and then they started wreaking havoc. Now, why they chose to wipe out his iCloud information is really unclear. The one hacker who had been interviewed said it was actually another hacker that was working with him and that he didn't do it. But regardless, unfortunately, Matt didn't have backups, and he lost some pretty valuable data, some photos of his children and relatives and stuff like that. So it's, it was a pretty bad hack, but the point being that this could have happened to any of us, even when we're using things like 1Password and really good security policies, because this hole was in how companies handled the information and handled resetting things. Now, of course, there's some additional things that could have been done to help slow the hackers down a little bit. Google offers something called two-factor authentication, which could have helped in this situation. You basically set up a system where to log into Gmail. If you come from an untrusted system or an untrusted computer, or every 30 days, you have to enter an additional bit of information attached to something physical that you have. In this case, it would be your mobile phone. They send you an SMS with an additional code. So when you log in on the website, it doesn't just take the username and password. It also sends you a text message, and you have to enter a 6-digit number, I think it is. So that could have helped. Using a separate non-related email address for your password reset for your alternate emails. So when you registered with Gmail, your alternate email address, if you just had an additional Yahoo account that wasn't attached to anything else, like your .Mac email, or some email that you actively use, you could set up that, and that would better protect you. So all your password resets just kind of go to this one email address. Another thing that would have helped in Matt's case would have been a private domain name registration, which is something, if you register domains, you can just pay a little bit extra yearly, and they will privatize your address information. But again, on that end, there were other mechanisms where they potentially could have gotten at that information. But even with all of that, that wouldn't necessarily have really helped, because a lot of this hack relied on these policies and sort of social engineering and manipulating people on the other end of a phone support line. And even with policies in place, those people could, we feel sympathetic. We feel bad. We've all been in that situation where we've been locked out of an account or we lost a password. And sometimes even a customer service rep will circumvent internal policies and to try and help someone out. So, the best thing you could do, I guess, would be make sure you have backups of your data. That's critical. We talk about that on the MacCast all the time. And, implement some of these other measures that would kind of slow people down. And, it was really humans that were the error here, not necessarily the technology. They were aided by technology, but, what are you going to do? It's the internet age. You can become a hermit and not go online, but that's not a world I want to live in, and I don't think that's one you want to live in either. So it's good to talk about these stories, to have them come up. They get a little bit sensationalized, which is why I wanted to kind of run down the actual process for those of you who didn't get into the details of exactly what happened, so you better understand and maybe can look at your own policies and how you handle your information and how you've connected accounts together and better protect yourself. If you'd be interested in a longer conversation about these topics and this hack, I did invite George Starcher on an upcoming episode of the MacCast Members show that should be out probably by the time you hear this, or most of you hear this. And we went a little more in depth into some of these things and a little bit about social engineering. And that's what we try and do on those shows, is go a little more in depth on a specific topic. But I think I gave you the basics here. So if you're not a member, you'll understand kind of what we talked about. But if you want to get a little bit more, check out the member show at member.maccast.com. If you've been wondering when Apple might be updating their desktop line of Macs, well, it might be just around the corner, or at least Mountain Lion seems to be giving some indication that Apple is planning some new models. Apple Insiders reported that the plist files for Boot Camp and Mountain Lion seem to reference new iMac and Mac Pro models. Of course, that doesn't tell us when they're coming out, just tells us that Apple's potentially working on some new designs. Those plist files are designed to tell Bootcamp which models of Macs can boot legacy operating systems via USB. According to the report, it's mostly for USB bootable versions of Windows 7 volumes on machines that wouldn't have optical drives. Things that are typically in the plist right now or prior to this finding were things like the MacBook Air, although some models of Macs with optical drives are also in that list. The opinion, though, is that these new models are being added to support the USB booting and boot camp because they'll be released without optical drives. Apple's been moving toward this trend of releasing models without optical drives, eliminating them, and it's believed by most people that new Mac Pros and iMac models at some point, probably in this next generation, aren't going to have optical drives, and I think that's a logical assumption. The important thing, though, is that these new plist files in Mountain Lion indicate an iMac 13.0 model and a Mac Pro 6.0 model. Those don't exist yet. The current generation Mac Pros are internally referenced as 5.1, and the current iMacs are in the 12 range. So some good indication that we might see some new desktops soon. Also supporting these rumors are some numbers that are showing up on Geekbench. That's typically a place where you can submit your machine to get some performance testing and compare it against other machines. Apple's used that system in the past. We've seen other new model Macs show up in Geekbench scores prior to them being released, so that does support this. Basically, a Geekbench score showed up indicating an iMac 13.2 model, and the Geekbench numbers showed that that system had an Intel Core i7-3770 quad-core processor running at 3.4 gigahertz. Geekbench also reported seeing scores for what appears to be a 13-inch MacBook Pro model, a Retina model. That was labeled as MacBook Pro 10.2, had an Intel Core i7-3520M Ivy Bridge processor clocked at 2.9 gigahertz. Also showed that it had 8 gigabytes of RAM and was running macOS 10.8.1, which is a version of Mountain Lion that was just released to developers for testing. So if all of those numbers pan out, it seems like Apple is planning some new models. Many are believing in a 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro is due out sometime soon as well. But I think a lot of people are really waiting on those desktops, especially the Mac Pro model, which actually Tim Cook came out after the last announcement when they just did that sort of token bump to the Mac Pro line and said, yes, we're working on something new for Mac Pro customers. He seemed to indicate that it would come out sometime early next year. So I don't know why we're seeing these numbers now. It'd be nice if Apple would release something soon, but you may be waiting until 2013 to see that. I'm not sure when they would release new iMac models either. But if you're in the market for either of those models and you don't need them in the next 4 to 6 months, you might want to hold off and see what Apple does. I'm guessing they'll do something with the desktops again in early 2013. Probably not anything before the holiday season, which is going to be taken up with, I think, the new iPhone 5 or the new iPhone, whatever it's going to end up being called, as well as potentially that new mini iPad tablet that we've been hearing about. IDC came out this last week with its latest numbers showing market share for the different smartphone operating systems, and I think it would be no surprise if I told you that Android is continuing to dominate the smartphone OS market, at least for the masses. In Q2, IDC says Android OS accounted for 68.1% of smartphones, more than two-thirds of smartphones running Android OS. iOS, for comparison, is powering 16.9% of devices, according to IDC. With Android devices, Samsung by far has the largest share of that market, coming in at 44% of all Android phones. And Apple and Android both continue to see growth. I have a feeling for iOS, come September, we're going to see a little bit more growth in those numbers, especially when Apple releases that new phone, which we're expecting. Probably going to happen toward the end of September, but more on that later. BlackBerry and Symbian, unfortunately, though, are losing market share. According to IDC, BlackBerry OS saw a 40.9% drop in market share in Q2, and Symbian saw a whopping 62.9% drop in market share and Q2. And what about Windows Phone? Well, they may be a contender. They just have 5.4% of the OS market in the second quarter, but they did see 115% year-over-year growth. And with Windows 8 just around the corner, probably going to be around the out around the fall time frame, right around the same time we see a new iPhone and iOS 6 from Apple, it'll be an interesting race. We're going to kind of have a three OS race, I think, with iOS, Android, and Windows Phone. It'll be interesting to see if Windows takes share from Apple, Android, or both, and what happens there, or if they just kind of all come on strong. But a lot of buzz around Windows 8, and it'll be interesting to see what happens. And speaking on the hardware front, we've had a lot of different leaks and seen different parts of the reported next generation iPhone, but now everything seems to be coming together, especially thanks to the crew over at Fix Your Eye. And a couple of reports recently this week from 9to5Mac. 9to5 had supposedly some leaked images of the new motherboard design that will be used in the next generation iPhone. And the Fix Your Eye crew took that image along with a bunch of the other part leak images that have come out over the past month or so and started to kind of match things up to see how the internals of the new iPhone would be assembled and to see if that kind of validates the different parts we've been seeing. And it turns out that it worked surprisingly well. If you look at the images, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, the parts all seem to fit, and we know that Apple is reportedly in assembly phases of those devices getting ready for their launch. What does the new motherboard leak tell us? Well, it looks like there's more antenna connectors that would support the theory that this new phone is going to have support for 4G LTE networks. There's also a new digitizer connector that could possibly support the rumors of a new display, one using the in-plane technology that'll marry the digitizer and the LCD into a single unit. That'll help Apple slim down the phone. Also, there's the SIM card tray, although in this latest report, it looks like it's a standard micro SIM tray. There'd been a lot of rumors that Apple was switching to a new nano SIM, something that's smaller than the traditional designs, but that one's been kind of flip-flopping back and forth. And so we've been hearing heavy rumors that carriers were starting to stock up on the new nano SIMs, but this latest image and some of the latest reports seem to indicate that they may be sticking with just a micro SIM like they have in the iPhone 4S right now. Comparisons of the new motherboard against the leaked backplate images also seem to indicate that that motherboard would fit. The mount points kind of line up almost exactly when you lay them over the two images over top of each other at scale. So it's looking like what we've been hearing about the iPhone 5 or whatever the next iPhone is, that stuff is looking to be pretty much valid. 9to5 also had a rumor about the battery. They had some information there, and what was surprising is that it seemed to be only slightly larger in capacity than the current iPhone 4S battery. They say it looks to be a 1440 milliamp hour 3.8 volt battery running at 5.45 watts per hour. That's just about 10 milliamp hours bigger in capacity than the iPhone 4S battery. And that would be a concern given the fact that we're hearing there's a larger display on the new iPhone and that it would have LTE, which most people know and understand sucks a lot more juice. And, you know, that's something that Android phones have suffered from in their designs. The Galaxy S3, for example, has a 2100 milliamp hour battery, and the latest Droids have like 3300 milliamp hour batteries. So much more juice, almost double in some cases than what seems to be indicated for the next generation iPhones. The question is Apple going to be able to eke performance out, battery performance and battery life out of this new device, or are we going to lose something on that front? The running theory is that Apple may gain some performance from a tweaked dual-core processor. Since they're doing their own processor designs, they can control a lot of that stuff, and since they do the software on top of that, they can marry those two things together and eke out much more performance. They're also thinking that they might go with some new LTE chip designs from Qualcomm that could reduce the power needs for the next generation iPhone. So we're going to have to see what Apple announces. And as far as when they're going to announce, we know that the rumors seem to be pointing to a September 12th event. It's expected that Apple at that event would show off its next generation iPhone along with iOS 6 and then give us a release date as well as those technical details, the specifications, pricing, and all that sort of stuff. But no one really knew when Apple would actually put the device on sale. Common running theory was that it would be within a week or two of that announcement. Well, now Boy Genius Reports claims to have a trusted source at AT&T who is saying that they are preparing for a iPhone release date sometime in the third or fourth week of September. And so that would seem to back up the original report from iMore that Apple would do an announcement on September 12th. So just to recap some of the details about the next generation iPhone, it's expected to have a taller but not wider display, a 4-inch or actually 3.99-inch display running at a resolution of 640 by 1136. That would basically allow for an extra row of icons if you're trying to picture what that might look like against your current iOS device, your current iPhone or iPod Touch. They would be using a thinner LCD panel, using that in-plane technology that would marry the digitizer and the LCD. It would have 4GE LTE support and possibly near-field communication for doing like mobile payments. I don't think that one's going to come true. I think Apple's not going that route. I think they're going to do something with Apple ID and something with a technology like Passbook that we're seeing in iOS 6. I don't think they have to go the route of actually having a near field thing in there. It just really hasn't taken off, especially in the US. I know globally it's a little more popular, but I just don't see Apple going that route. I think there's security concerns and what have you, but that's just my personal opinion. It's also expected that we're going to see a new chip in there, although it's probably going to be a slightly tweaked version of the A5X chip that is in the current iPad. So they'll tweak that a little bit. One rumor I read said that they expect it to have a full gig of RAM, which will be a nice bump up. I think that's double from what is in the current iPhone. And that we'll have that thinner design and a smaller dock connector, a 9-pin connector. And there were some recently leaked photos that reportedly showed that connector. If you look at the images, I was looking at it and I initially started counting pins and it looked like there were only 8 pins. And all the reports had been saying 9, so I thought that was odd. But as Apple Insider pointed out, you have to count the shell of the connector as a potential 9th pin. So that would equal 9. And it's also been reported that the design is orientation free, because if you look at it, it's got the same pin configuration on both sides and it's a purely symmetrical connector. So it'd be like just like your MagSafe, where you could attach it in either orientation and have it work. Although unlike the MagSafe and unlike prior rumors, this latest design does not appear to be a magnetic connector. So it actually looks like it inserts into the slot in the bottom of the phone. And as far as how Apple would support prior accessories, most people believe there's going to be some sort of adapter that's either included in the box or probably more likely an add-on accessory that you're going to have to buy after the fact. And that's going to make some customers not happy, but it's really not going to impact new customers. And if you're wondering how the 30 pins can go down to 9 pins, if you look up on Apple's website, or I did some research on this, a lot of those pins are really dedicated to things like FireWire and analog audio, a lot of legacy technologies that really aren't in use anymore, especially with modern devices and modern accessories and stuff like that. So they should be able to handle everything with an adapter, at least with current modern accessories. If you have some older accessories, they may cease to function on the new device. And with that, that's going to do it for the news for this week. Before I move on, I want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show sponsors. That's Gazelle. You know, you can get cash for your old Mac or your iOS device, and you can do it in a real easy, pain-free way. You don't have to deal with the hassles of classifieds and auction sites or doing private sales. You can just head to gazelle.com. They also handle Android smartphones, so if you want to upgrade from an Android to an iOS device and get a little cash, they can help you do that. But basically what you do is you go to the website, you do a search for your device. They actually have it set up pretty easy. They've even got little pictures on the website now, I noticed, where you can just pick the device that you have. You answer some simple questions about that device, its condition, what kinds of accessories that you have, and then within moments, they make you an offer for that device. And you see it right there on screen. You can choose to accept it or not. But if you accept their offer, then what you do is you send your device in. They'll pay for the shipping, and you send that along with all the accessories. And when they receive it, they review it, evaluate it. And as long as everything checks out, it matches the condition and has the accessories that you said it had, then you get paid. You can get paid by check, by PayPal, or Amazon gift card. And if you're worried about security or data, they even securely and privately erase your data. Although, personally, I'd reset and erase the device before I sent it in. That's perfectly fine. But, they try and make the whole process as easy and as seamless as possible. So it takes the worry and the hassle out of selling your old devices. You can try it out today. You can check it all out and get more information over at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. Recently, we've been having a conversation in the MacCast community about what makes a pro machine a pro machine, and that was sort of spawned by Apple's release of the Retina MacBook Pros, but also to a certain degree by the MacBook Air and the fact that Apple's going to these sealed designs and components soldered to the motherboard and things like that. You know, another long-running and common topic we have in the MacCast community is backup, and Sebastian kind of took those two, mixed them up, and made a really good point about a reason why you might need backup even more than ever.
Hi, Adam. It's Sebastian from Germany. I know that you are an advocate of a comprehensive backup strategy, and rightly so. I have one new argument for you and your listeners why backups are becoming increasingly important these days. If your Mac fails, you could always hope that your hard drive is not the cause of the problem. You would be able to open up your Mac and take the hard drive out, put it into an USB enclosure, and get your data off the drive that way. Now, however, an increasing number of people have SSDs in their Macs, and as far as I know, there is no way of soldering out the SSD chips and saving your data that way. Therefore, I believe that backing up your data is more important than ever. Love your show, and thank you very much for a long contribution to the Mac community.
Hey, thanks, Sebastian. Thanks for your voicemail. I think that's a very good point and something that we do need to think about moving forward as more and more of us get devices that have flash storage from Apple, stuff that's soldered to the motherboard, or in some cases it's on actually a daughter card, so potentially you could get it out of there, and if you had the right kind of adapter or connector, maybe you could get off. But your point is well taken. It's going to be much more difficult than what we have, or what many of us have today, which is if something went wrong with our machine but the hard drive was still okay, we could pull the hard drive out, hook that up to a connector device, one of these adapters that can plug in via USB or FireWire or Thunderbolt, and we can potentially get the data off of that. Something else that was pointed out recently, the Mac Observer just posted an article. Jim Tanis over there wrote a piece about how to recover data, how Matt Honan, who we were talking about earlier, might have recovered data from his device, using software recovery. Since his disk was remotely wiped, the question was, can you get in there and run some of the recovery tools on it and actually get that data back? And what they discovered, and I had not thought about this before, is that SSD drives have the trim support in them. When they erase the data, it's much more erased and gone than our traditional platter drives. With those drives, we can go in with a recovery tool and have a good chance of getting those back, just standard over-the-counter recovery tools. I'm sure if you sent it to a forensic lab someplace like DriveSavers, they might be able to do a little bit deeper scanning on it. But just with the commercially available tools, they had much more success. The Mac Observer had much more success recovering data from a remotely wiped drive when it was a spindle drive versus the SSD drive that was in a Mac. So backups are going to be even more important, because if you have the backups, you don't have to worry about running recovery tools. You can just go to your backup and get your data back. So very good points and something to consider as we move toward SSDs and flash-based drives that many of us want, because it really increases performance. And it's the wave of the future, but that just means doing your backups are going to be even a more important part of that future. And I guess I should ask, what about a backup for your hardware? Those of you who follow me on Twitter probably know this past week was very interesting for me. Actually, very interesting and frightening for the life of my iPhone 4S and my new iPad. I'll give you a brief story. I went into this in great detail on a member episode of the MacCast. But in essence, I was last week getting ready to go out to a coffee shop, and I was going to do a little bit of research while I was there. And so I was bringing my iPad and my iPhone with me, went out to get in the car, and it was trash day. And so I went paused for a moment to bring the trash cans in. And when I did that, I set my devices on top of my car. How many of us do that, right? And I've done that a million times and never had a problem. But lo and behold, this one time, I left the devices on top of the car and drove off and did not even realize that I didn't have them till I got to this coffee shop that was about 10 minutes away from my home. So 10-minute panic drive back, wondering, what happened to them? Did they fall off in my driveway, or were they in the middle of this high traffic road that's near my house? Well, it turned out it was the worst of those two scenarios, and it was on a major road at rush hour. And needless to say, the iPad was completely destroyed. The pictures are on Twitter if you want to take a look. And somehow my iPhone 4S came out relatively unscathed with just the back glass cracked. But at that point, I tweeted out some things. Many of you tweeted back saying, hey, I hope you have AppleCare Plus, which is Apple's new AppleCare warranty that provides for accidental damage coverage like this. So for $49 US, they will replace your device if you have AppleCare Plus. Now, I had made a conscious decision not to buy AppleCare Plus, and there's a lot of reasons for that. Again, I go into those in the membership episode. But in essence, it comes down to the number of iOS devices that I've owned over the years and how much money I would be paying up front versus what it would cost me to do a replacement cost. Now, in this scenario, it was my new iPad, which was not very old, and it was a 64 gigabyte Wi-Fi model, so $699 US, not cheap. And believe me, I had the pit of my stomach just turning and churning, you know, and it was an awful, awful feeling. But I thought, you know what, I'll make a Genius Bar appointment, I'll go into the Apple Store, and I'll see what they will do. If they have, if they take pity on me, what will happen? You know, it was worth a shot. So I went in there, and I discovered that Apple has something called an out-of-warranty service program for their iOS devices. This would be iPhones. I'm assuming iPod Touches. I didn't look into it for those devices, but also iPads. And so if you have not purchased the AppleCare Plus, you can get out-of-warranty coverage service for a fee. And the replacement cost for an iPhone 4S, it turns out, is $199 US. For a new iPad, it's $299 US. And for an iPad 2, it's $249 US. And it's a like-for-like swap. So the price is the same regardless of which model you have, but whichever model you're bringing in for out-of-warranty service, it gets replaced with a similar model. So in my case, it was a 64 gigabyte Wi-Fi iPad. Apple went ahead and they replaced that for $299. Now, I found out later after researching this a little bit that I think the genius took a little bit of pity on me, because in looking at the actual coverage on Apple's website, and this is officially stated on Apple's website, it said that they would cover damage for things like water damage with this out-of-warranty service coverage, but that extreme damage, things like, for example, where parts of the device separated, may or may not, or are not necessarily covered. Basically, Apple reserves the right at their discretion to determine whether or not your device is eligible for their out-of-warranty service. So this genius allowed it to be eligible, took the old damaged iPad. Oh, it was awful. There were pieces of glass falling out. The FaceTime camera was completely destroyed. Surprisingly, it did still turn on. The LCD still turned on. The sort of right half was darkened a little bit because it had been crushed on the back, and I was able to actually wipe my data off of it, which was a good peace of mind for me. I could actually get in there and wipe the data, and the genius even asked me if I wanted to do that, so I thought that was nice service. But they really, once again, took care of me over at AppleCare, and it just reaffirmed my thoughts that their support is really good. And they did offer me AppleCare Plus on the replacement device, and I went ahead and purchased it this time, although I still am not 100% convinced that for everyone it is the way to go. If you're really careful with your devices, and I've gone years and years and years without accidentally damaging any of my iOS devices, and so in the long run, I think I'm better off by not buying it, but we can start up a conversation and we can make the argument for and against AppleCare Plus and maybe some of the other third-party services that are out there. But it looked to me like in comparing AppleCare Plus to some of the third-party offerings that you're better off with AppleCare Plus because it's about the same price. You might get a little longer coverage with another third-party service, but the hassle-free replacement that Apple's going to offer when something does happen, I think, is worth the little bit of extra money that you might spend just for that added convenience. But I'd be curious to find out, you know, are you an advocate for AppleCare Plus, or do you do what I do, is just sort of roll the dice and hope that something doesn't happen? And again, it comes down to fate, right? I could turn around and do something stupid again tomorrow. You know, I don't know why I did in this one instance, but I absolutely did, and I can almost guarantee you I won't be making that mistake again, because it was not a fun day that day that I did almost destroyed both of my iOS devices. Oh, and I guess I should mention, for those who are wondering, the back glass on my iPhone 4S, that was a just straight $29.99 replacement from Apple at the Apple store. So they just swapped out the back glass and I was back in business for that. So I thought that was a very reasonable, again, very reasonable repair, because when I looked up replacement parts, it was about the same price for me to order replacement parts. And then I was going to have to find the Pentalobe screwdriver and it was going to be a lot more hassle. So I just let Apple do it. And out the door, I had all my devices and everything back in order within hours. Of course, I was a little lighter in the pocketbook. So we should probably talk a little bit about Mountain Lion and some of the feedback that I've been getting from you. And surprisingly, it's very little feedback. Well, a lot of feedback, but most of it is just saying the same thing, that there have been very few issues with upgrading to Mountain Lion. It seems like many of you are taking my strategy and doing the clean install upgrade, but also many of you are just doing the straight over-the-top update on top of Lion. And I think whether you do one or the other comes down to how well your current Lion system is running. If you're not really having issues, or if you're having minor issues, and I think I even said this in another episode, that I think for 98% of people, just an over-the-top upgrade, especially with Mountain Lion, since I don't think a ton of stuff has changed under the hood, I think that's going to work for most people. And then there's a small percentage of people that probably want to do a erase the drive, install the operating system, and then just restore from your Time Machine backup or your Carbon Copy clone or Super Duper clone, bring all your data back over using the Setup Assistant. And that's a pretty straightforward process as well. A little bit cleaner, but not a true, you know, like completely erase the extreme thing that I do, which is erase the drive, just install the operating system, and then manually move things back over. And for me, that's really more about house cleaning than anything else. It's me cleaning off all the old junk that I have in my system. But overall, everybody seems to be pretty happy with the Mountain Lion upgrade, and I'm hearing reports online that for most people it's going very, very smoothly. So that's a nice thing to hear. The complaints that I have been seeing mostly come from those who were eligible for the free upgrade because they bought a new Mac recently, and Apple really seemed to, this seems more like of a process issue, that Apple handled it really badly. Not necessarily that there was a problem with the operating system itself, but the whole way that you had to go about getting your free update. I had one listener report back to me that he had to apply for the update, and I think that's actually normal. I think you normally would have to apply for the update, and in the past, Apple would send you a DVD, or I don't know in Mountain Lion if they sent you the USB key or if they just sent you a code like they did this time, but this time around, they sent you a code for the Mac App Store. And unfortunately, as part of the application process, you had to provide a proof of purchase of your Mac, your receipt. And this listener said he had to send in a JPEG image. So you'd have to find a scanner, or you'd have to take your receipt and convert it to a JPEG. I don't know why they couldn't just take the PDF copy of your receipt if you had it mailed to you. But even more so, if you had registered your Mac with your Apple Store ID, why wouldn't Apple already have that information or that purchase information, especially if you bought through an Apple Store or through Apple Online? I guess I could understand if you went through a third-party reseller that you'd maybe need to provide proof of purchase, but Apple should have those records. In this case, he had bought, I believe, from an Apple Store, and they still wanted that information. And also, if you had registered that Mac with your Apple Store ID, why couldn't they just recognize that and sort of activate your upgrade in the App Store rather than having to provide you a code? Because the code also caused a problem for those people who don't use redemption codes on Apple's websites. If you've never used an iTunes redemption code or if you've never used an app redemption code, it might not make sense how Apple handles it, because if you've ever done it, you know that Apple sort of does it in reverse of most sites like Amazon. If you get a coupon code for Amazon or most other services, you plug that in during checkout, right? You hit buy, you check out, and at some point they say, hey, enter your coupon code and we'll give you your discount. With Apple, it's not a coupon code, it's a redemption code. So you have to go to the store and click on the little redeem button, enter the code, and then that software is downloaded. But not everybody is going to know that up front. And I'm not sure that Apple was really clear about that. So I know some users got caught by the fact that they went, hit the buy button, and because they had one click purchasing turned on, they ended up buying Mountain Lion rather than getting their free upgrade, and resolving that through customer service was another big chore. And of course, we know some of the technical glitches that happened with Apple sending out codes that ended up being for the Mountain Lion server upgrade, and it was just a whole big mess. So Apple has some work to do on that end. But beyond that, I think the software itself is running very well. I did see some complaints online recently about battery life being reduced, and I think I've experienced that a little bit on my MacBook Air. It does seem to suck battery a little bit quicker. I have no information about this, and I saw other people online with the same theory, but my initial theory was that it was possibly bugs related to the new PowerNap feature, which allows the system to kind of do things when it's asleep, right? You put it to sleep, but it can still wake itself up and check for notification updates, do software updates, do some of these other functions. I have a feeling that maybe that's not running as smoothly as Apple was hoping. And while you think your machine's asleep and not using a lot of power, it's actually sucking up juice. I have no hard evidence to support it yet, but that's just my general theory. So hopefully a software update will patch that sort of thing. Beyond that, I'm not hearing too many bugs. If you've run into some specific bugs, please share those with us, maccast@gmail.com. I'd be curious to know any problems. And especially if you've run into a bug and found a resolution that you might be able to share with the community, that's always very helpful. One interesting thing, a new feature that's in there that a lot of us haven't seen working, and I hadn't seen working, is Mac Game Center. So we're used to the Game Center features on iOS, but that has now been brought to the Mac operating system with Mountain Lion. And Richard sent me an email to point out that a great way to test that out is through the chess application that's built into Mac OS X. That's already Game Center enabled. So if you want to see how it works when you log in and the Game Center information comes down when you log in, assuming you've set up Game Center, you can see achievements. If you go in the chess application under moves, there's an achievements option, so you can see how those come up within the application. And then once you've launched the chess app and you've been logged into Game Center, it'll show up as one of your games in Game Center when you launch the Game Center app. So you can go into the Game Center app, and from there you can challenge friends to a game of chess, and you can see how the invite process works. That was a little bit convoluted when I dove into it. The way I was able to get to it, maybe I didn't do this in the most efficient way, was I went into the launched Game Center, went into the Games tab, selected the chess game, and then clicked on the Players tab, and then I was able to select a player in the Friends section, and then I had to click the chess game again, and I'm not sure why I had to do this. I had to click chess again, which went to my friends page with the chess application, and then I could click the play game button, and then at that point it would launch the chess application and then bring up the multiplayer window that would allow me to invite a friend. But rather than inviting the friend whose page I was already on in Game Center, I had to once again select the friend that I wanted to play against from that multiplayer window, and then I could send a notification requesting to play the game. So it seemed a little bit of a more involved process than it needed to be. But if you want to check that stuff out, check out the chess application if you don't have another app, another game app that's been Game Center enabled on your Mac. Another big topic of conversation is the return of, or as it's turning out to be, the not return of the save as command. Save as, apparently, even though it's back in Mountain Lion, and I think I covered this tip on the last episode, where if you hold down the option key going under the file menu, you do get the save as rather than the duplicate option. Doesn't save as the way we're used to, where, you know, you open up a document that you've had in the past, you start editing it, and then you choose save as, give it a new name, and now you have a new file with all of those changes, but the original file is left intact and untouched. With the save as that's in Mountain Lion, it actually saves the same information to the original copy and the new copy. So you end up with two copies of the same thing, and getting your original version back on the original document that you started with is a little bit tricky. What you have to do is you have to use versions the next time you open up that application, or this is the only way I can figure out how to do it. You open up the original document, click on the title the next time you're in it, and then you can go under the versions and choose previous save, and that will revert it back to the original save point before you did the save as. That is not intuitive at all. I don't know how anybody would understand that or figure that out, and it is a big hassle. Somebody told me that if you go into the system preferences and go under general, that there's a setting you can change. Typically, by default, what happens is there's an option that says ask to keep changes when closing documents. That checkbox is by default not on, meaning that it will just autosave, and when you close the document, it will save that document. In this case, when you close a document, it will actually prompt you and say, do you want to save it or do you want to revert it? Now, you would think this would work because when you choose a save as, essentially what happens is your original document, it makes a duplicate, and then the original document automatically closes in the background, and then you have the new document that you've done the save as. But in my testing, I did not get a dialog pop-up for the original document, and when I went back to look at my two documents, they were both saved with, still saved with the same changes. The one thing that changing the system preferences general setting and checking the ask to keep changes when closing documents option, when you check that back on, you do get the little black dot in the stoplight, you know, close, maximize, minimize icons in your document window. You do get that little black dot back that says, hey, you've made changes to this document, you haven't saved them yet. That feature comes back, and I know some people really like that. Now with the versions, you do have the little indication in the title bar where it'll say edited next to the file name. So it's a little bit redundant, but if you want to get that feature back, you can turn that on by changing that setting. To do a save as, you know, it really seems to be what you need to do now is reverse the process that you're used to. So opening up the original document and then having the very first thing that you do be do the save as. And that will save both copies at that point with no changes in them. And then you can start working on your new document and save to it normally. And you're not going to overwrite your original document. So you can't open up the document, start making changes, and then do save as. You have to open up the document and do your save as, which really only saves one step from what we had in Lion, which was open up the document, choose duplicate, create the duplicate document, rename it, and, well, I guess it saves more steps now that I'm walking through it. you can get to editing, starting with an original document, creating a copy of it in sort of one step now without having to jump through all the hoops. Although with Mountain Lion, if you want to use the duplicate option, you can just automatically, and I think it defaults to putting you right there, change the name of the saved as document right in the title bar. And so it's, you know, a little less of a difference between the two different versions, but I thought I'd dive into that a little bit because it certainly is confusing. I mean, you can hear me talking about it now. I'm even a little bit confused as I'm trying to relate it to you, so I apologize if this is confusing, but basically it's not much different than using the duplicate, so I don't know what Apple's thinking. They got to give us a standard save as back, or just don't give us back the feature. You know, don't make it this convoluted thing that doesn't work the way that it used to. And a feature that a lot of people are very excited about, and we talked about on last MacCast, is the dictation feature that is in Mountain Lion. A lot of people are really excited that we have speech to text anywhere that you can basically input text into the operating system. And you have to turn the feature on, and you have to opt into some things because that information and data is actually sent out through the cloud to Apple servers and gets translated not on your Mac, but out over the internet. And Roger pointed out a good piece over on Sophos. It's something worth mentioning, especially since we talked a little bit earlier about security and privacy and, you know, what we're doing with our data and putting it out there. We need to be aware of what's going on. And there are warnings in place when you turn the feature on. Apple explains some things about this, but there was a great piece over on the Sophos website that went into it in a little more detail. But in essence, when you turn the feature on, what Apple will tell you is that when you're using the keyboard dictation feature in Mountain Lion, you will have your recordings sent out to Apple's servers, and then their servers will convert that to text. But not only that, is that your computer will send additional information along your contact address book information. It'll prompt you and say, do you want to send this information? And the reason for that is that it'll take the first names, the nicknames, the relationships that you have in there. So if you said, you know, this person is my spouse, these are my kids, this is my cousin, this is my friend, all of those things, it will send that information up to Apple's servers as well. And the reason they say they do that is to help with the dictation feature, to help it better understand and recognize what you're saying. So if you say, you know, Bob so-and-so, it'll recognize that so-and-so is the last name of someone in your contacts, and it can infer, oh, that's Bob. And if Bob is your uncle, then Bob's your uncle. If Bob is your uncle, then it can match that up and do some logical things about what you might be saying in the dictation that it's trying to translate. But, you know, that's personal information, and you kind of have to decide, do I want Apple, do I really trust Apple kind of knowing that relationship, knowing this information about me? And you would assume they're not going to do anything nefarious with it, but they have access to the information. And it gets a little bit trickier when you find out what happens if you turn off the dictation feature and you've already given them access to that information. And this is pointed out in that Sophos piece as well. It says that Apple will delete your user data as well as your recent voice input data, but older voice input data that has been disassociated from you may be retained for a period of time to generally improve dictation and other Apple products and services. This voice input data may include audio files and transcripts of what you said. So the things that you're saying into the dictation software could be kept and retained by Apple for who knows how long. They really don't specify. They say for a period, quote unquote, period of time. So is that forever? Is that a year? We really don't know. So you need to understand, in using the dictation feature, you're giving Apple access to certain information, to your voice, to things that you might say when you're dictating stuff. And it sounds like at a certain point, they're disassociating that from your account. So maybe it can't get tracked back. But if you say something unique enough in your messages, especially coupled with maybe some of the other data that they have, it could be used. And of course, we can get paranoid about this stuff, right? You start thinking about it, and it really then at the end of the day, I think, comes down to a trust issue. Who do you trust? Do you trust Apple with your information, or do you not? And if you don't, you might not want to enable that feature, as cool as it is. You know, I'm going to continue to use it. I really don't mind, but I might give a second thought to sort of what I decide to dictate into my Mac and what I might keep a little bit private. And that just might be something you want to consider. And I think I want to thank Roger for pointing that article out to me. It's a great article, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. Last thing that I want to comment on isn't necessarily related to Mountain Lion, but it's related to Safari 6. And it's an interesting thing that somebody pointed out to me. In the past, if you always went to apple.com/, I want to say Safari, or it might have been Mac OS X Safari or OS X Safari, whatever. If you went to the Safari page on Apple's website, you could always download the most recent version of Safari. Well, with Safari 6, Apple pushed it out through software update, and there does not appear to be any way on Apple's website, through software update, through the Mac App Store, to re-download a copy of Safari. So if you needed to reinstall Safari 6, I'm not entirely certain how you go about doing it. There's a thread on Apple's discussion board that talks about it, and they actually link to a direct link for the version of Safari 6 for Lion coming off Apple's CDN, their content delivery network. So I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com, but just be aware that that is the version for Lion, not Mountain Lion. So I don't know if you needed to reinstall Safari 6 on Mountain Lion, how you would go about doing that beyond just completely reinstalling in the entire operating system. I haven't personally checked to see if you could just do a selective install from the recovery partition. Didn't get a chance to do that before the show. But if you happen to know, let us know, maccast@gmail.com. But those are just some of the things that have been noticed about Mountain Lion and some of the features and things like that that I wanted to share with you this week. So another thing that came up that's interesting is what happens if you want to go back to Lion and you've upgraded to Mountain Lion, especially if you purchased Lion through the Mac App Store like many of us did. That doesn't appear to be available for direct download. When you go into the Mac App Store, if you've purchased Mountain Lion, it seems like you just re-download Mountain Lion. And unless you made a USB recovery disk, how do you get back to Lion? How could you restore it? Well, I guess if you're like me and you have clone backups of Lion and you've retained those backups, you could use your clone and sort of restore everything back through SuperDuper or Carbon Copy Cloner. But listener Ben discovered something very interesting. If you have a Mac that supports the Lion Internet recovery partition, this is the thing where if you boot into your recovery partition and you need to go out to Apple servers on the internet and re-download a copy of the operating system, it can do that. This is like if your internal hard drive failed and that recovery partition that is on your internal hard drive was completely wiped or destroyed, it would go out to Apple servers. Some models of Macs, more recent ones, will go out to Apple servers and can actually download over the internet, boot over the internet, and then download the installers and reinstall the operating system. Well, what he discovered was he had done a Mountain Lion install or was doing a Mountain Lion install and something happened. It didn't work. He had to boot to the recovery partition, but because he was doing a clean install and had wiped the internal hard drive and it failed in the middle of the Mountain Lion installation, he did not have a recovery partition to boot into, but he had one of the Macs that would go to the internet recovery partition. Well, when it did that, he noticed that it actually was a Lion partition, and when it re-downloaded from Apple servers, it re-downloaded Lion, not Mountain Lion, which is what he had purchased. So it seems like the internet recovery partition boots to whatever operating system you had when your Mac was shipped to you, or at least that seems to be the indication according to Ben. If anybody has verification of this, I wasn't able to test it, please let us know, maccast@gmail.com. But that might be, for some of you, a way to get back to Lion if you're unhappy with Mountain Lion. Although, as I was mentioning earlier, most people aren't unhappy with Mountain Lion. It seems to actually perform better than Lion. A lot of people I've heard saying, even with less memory, or with the same amount of memory they were running Lion on, Mountain Lion is running a little bit zippier and snappier. So if you've had issues with Lion, you might even consider just upgrading to maybe get a little bit of a performance boost. I would still recommend that you have at least 4 gigs of RAM. If you can have 8 or more, I think that's preferred with both Lion and Mountain Lion. As I was mentioning earlier, more and more Macs are starting to ship with flash storage, or more and more of us are considering replacing our old hard drives with SSD drives to take advantage of the faster performance that solid-state drives offer. Unfortunately, in a cost per gigabyte model, you know, how much we pay per gigabyte of storage, SSD is going to give us a lot less bang for our buck. And so typically when most of us are upgrading to an SSD or buying a new Mac with flash storage, we're ending up with actually less storage than we have on our current Macs. And this presents a problem of what do we do with all this data we've been accumulating, especially in things like our iPhoto libraries and our iTunes libraries, that just seems to be growing bigger and bigger. We download more movies, we load more photos, we get higher megapixel digital cameras, HD files. So those file sizes grow, yet now we're having our actual storage devices shrink a little bit. And this question comes up a lot these days. This week, Zach sent me an email and he said, you know, I have this ever-growing iPhoto library and this ever-shrinking amount of available disk space. What can I do? You know, I want to be able to maybe break up my iPhoto libraries into smaller chunks and manage them. I don't want to just move my entire library to an external drive, which is how many of us have managed this in the past, right? You just move your entire iTunes library or iPhoto library to an external drive. Zach was more interested in, can I set this up in a way where I can have sort of parts of my iPhoto library, maybe the most recent stuff or just my photos and not my movies in my iPhoto library on my Mac, but then have larger files or archived libraries on an external. So he wanted some ideas on how to split up his large iPhoto library between an internal and an external drive. And like I said, the first thing I do or tell most people to do is just, you know what, move your whole iPhoto library to an external drive. That's fairly easy and straightforward. If you've never done that before, basically all you have to do is quit iPhoto if it's running. Then you go into your home folder, into pictures, and locate your iPhoto library file. And for those who don't know, it's technically a package file. So if you control click or right click on it and choose show package contents, you'll see it's really like a folder and you can dig in there and see individual files in there. You don't want to mess around with those things because it's really a self-contained thing. But just be aware that technically it's a package. It's not just a file itself. But to the operating system and to most people, it just looks like a file. So you can take that file, and now would be a good time to also make an archive backup of it if you haven't. So just copy it onto another external drive or burn it to a disk if it's of a size that you can get on a DVD or something like that. And of course, you also have your regular backups too, right? Because you're a MacCast listener, you have your clone backup and your Time Machine backup. And so now you have three copies of it, and nothing bad's going to happen when I tell you this process. But make a backup of it, have an archive before you try any of this. But basically, find your iPhoto library, and then you can copy that entire iPhoto library to your external drive, wherever you want to keep it stored. And then once it's over there, go ahead and launch iPhoto, but launch it while holding down the Option key. And when you do that, a dialog box will come up, and it'll ask you if you want to find your iPhoto library, if you want to use the default one, which is going to be the one that you just moved or just copied from your default location. And you can also set up a brand new iPhoto library. We'll talk more about that here in a second. But in this instance, you're going to want to use the choose option, click choose, and then navigate and find that iPhoto library that you just moved to your external drive. And when you select that and hit OK, it'll boot up and iPhoto will look just like it did, hopefully, when you had it pointed at your internal library, but now that library lives on an external drive. And you'll want to verify that. You'll want to do a final check by maybe quitting iPhoto, moving your original iPhoto library. Just move it, say, to the Documents folder someplace where iPhoto wouldn't find it, basically breaking that link, and then relaunch iPhoto. If it opens up and it asks you to find the location of your library file, then it probably wasn't pointed at the external drive. If it boots up fine and you see all your photos and can manipulate them, open them, make sure you open up a couple photos, make sure you didn't get any corruption when you copy the library over, make sure everything's working fine. But once you've done that, you can rest assured that your iPhoto library has been moved to that external drive. And I keep my original one around for a couple days, a week or two, just to make sure that when I'm adding new photos, they're going to the new library on the external. But once you've verified all that, you could ultimately and eventually, to save space on your internal drive, delete that iPhoto library. Again, because you're going to have those backups, you're going to have that archive. So if anything really went wrong, you can always go back to that. So that's fairly straightforward. You still only have a single library file, but now it's on your external. And so that means you also need to always have that external drive with you if you want to be able to access your photos that are on there and add more data to it and what have you. So the easy thing to do for this is get a small bus-powered portable hard drive. I like to use 2.5-inch drives. I order most of my drives from OWC, but you can get them from Fry's or Costco or wherever you buy hard drives from, and just have one that you can carry around with you. And having it be bus powered is really convenient because you can just plug it into USB and not have to worry about, you know, carrying a power cord, something like that. But it does mean that you have to have that external drive and with you and available. And another thing is, once you've moved your iPhoto library to the external drive, make sure that you rejigger your backup strategy to include that external drive. I've known many people who have moved stuff to their external drives and forgotten to put those into their online backup strategy, into their time machine, into their cloned backup strategy. So make sure that you add that when you move it. But, you know, what if you want to have your photos in multiple places? You want to have some on an external and you want to have some on an internal. Well, one option that has always been available with iPhoto is you could just choose to leave the files in place, meaning that when you add photos to your iPhoto library, they don't get copied into that library file. The metadata does, but the actual physical original files stay in their original location wherever you imported them from. And this is a setting in iPhoto. You just go into iPhoto Preferences, and under Advanced for the importing setting, make sure you uncheck the option that says Copy Items to iPhoto Library. With that unchecked, anytime that you add new items to your iPhoto Library, they're not going to be copied. They're just going to be simply pointed at wherever that original location was. And you just need to know, if you do this, that if you move the originals, it can break the reference, and therefore when you open up iPhoto, you might get missing photo icons. You might click on a photo to try and edit it, and it'll say, I can't find that photo. Please tell me where it is. I have to say, though, that OS X is pretty smart now about keeping track of them. I think they use the Spotlight Index to kind of indicate. So even moving a photo original around on your hard drive might not break the link to iPhoto, but you can. And obviously, if you delete the originals outside of iPhoto, they're going to be lost to iPhoto. And a nice feature about iPhoto and having it copy your photos into that library file is that library file is kind of self-contained. You don't really get in there and mess with it too much. So your photos are going to stay inside iPhoto. If you break that and use this referencing where you leave the files in place, you need to be a little bit more aware of what's going on. The other thing you need to know is that if you edit a photo that's referenced, iPhoto still makes a copy of that. It doesn't edit the original. It makes a copy of the original, and it saves that copy into the iPhoto library. So if you're doing a lot of editing, you're still going to build up a large iPhoto library. And if that iPhoto library is on your internal drive, you're still going to be eating up additional storage space. So I generally don't recommend leaving the files in place unless you really know what you're doing, and that's absolutely what you want to do. The other option, and the one that I think is probably going to work best for you, Zach, would be to create a second iPhoto library. And you can set up a second iPhoto library and put that on the external drive and then just move the photos that you want on that external drive into that. Or in your case, you mentioned, you know, having large movie files that are in iPhoto. You could just take your movie files and drag them over to your desktop and then drag them into that other iPhoto library. So if you want to create a second iPhoto library, what you can do is you can hold down the Option key when you're launching iPhoto and choose that Create New option. And then you just pick the location for your new iPhoto library, your external drive, for example, and it'll create that new library. And now you have a blank library that you can start adding images and files to. If you want to move images into that, what you're going to need to do is quit iPhoto, hold down the Option key again, select your old library location. When that opens up, find the images and the photos and stuff that you, and video files that you want to put in the other library. You're going to have to export them out or drag them out. I think dragging them out to a folder on the desktop or some location is the easiest way to go. Drag them out. That'll make copies of all of them. And then switch back to the library on the external, sort of repeating this process, and then drag those files from wherever you put them, say on your desktop, back into that new library. And now you're going to have duplicate copies. You can verify that everything moved, and you can open it up in the new library location. Then you can go back to that original library and delete the originals to kind of save that space on your internal drive. But you can see here that every time you want to switch iPhoto libraries, you're going to have to do this little Option key dance when you're launching iPhoto and pick the correct library and sort of move back and forth. So not necessarily convenient, but it does allow you to kind of have two libraries set up that you can jump back and forth between. But another caveat to setting up and splitting your libraries this way is that when you drag the originals out of iPhoto or export them out of iPhoto, it doesn't actually export the originals. It exports the versions that iPhoto created. So if you ever did editing to an image, it's going to give you a copy of the edited version, not the true original version. If you want to get at the original file, you're going to have to go to the individual files, specifically the ones that you edited, and select them in iPhoto, go under the file menu and choose, go under Reveal in Finder, and then select the original file option. That will take you inside that iPhoto library package to the actual original file, the one that existed before you did any editing. And then you could copy that file out and put it into your new iPhoto library that's on your external drive. So that's just not convenient at all. Another trick or workaround could be if you have a whole album or something that you want to extract all of the original files for, actually create an iPhoto library from that you can put on an external. When you burn a CD or a DVD from inside iPhoto using its burn option, it actually creates an entire iPhoto library with just the items that you have selected. So I've done this in the past for archiving images, right? I'll create a year's worth of photos using a smart album and then select that smart album and burn that to a CD or a DVD. And what's nice about that is when you put that DVD back in, it actually has an iPhoto library. So you can hold the option key down to select that iPhoto library and just view that iPhoto library along with all of its metadata. That's the other thing to point out is when you just drag images out of iPhoto, you can lose the metadata, specifically like the edited copies, some of the information that went along with that. You're just getting the JPEG file. So anything that's not saved in the JPEG file and iPhoto saves some of its own metadata into its library file, that gets lost when you import into another library that you've just created as a new library on that external. So none of this is ideal. I don't know why Apple doesn't give us an easy way to, on disk, create or split up an iPhoto library. So say, I want to take all these photos that are in my iPhoto library, and I want you to take all of their metadata information, all their library information, and I want you to create a new library with just these items in it. Apple does not give you a way to do that out of the box. Luckily for all of this, and I think this is the ultimate solution, there is a very good third-party tool that can help you with this. It's been updated for Mountain Lion. It's called iPhoto Library Manager, and it's from Fat Cat Software. It's $20 US, so I think it's well worth it. And you can use it to manage multiple libraries, and it does things like allows you to easily see where their location is. That's something that iPhoto doesn't do. It doesn't easily show you, even when you have iPhoto pointed at a library, where is that library? Is it the one on my internal, or is it the one on my external? iPhoto Library Manager also allows you to copy albums and events between multiple libraries and retain not only their originals, but also all of that data. So if you want to copy this album from your internal library over to the external library, you can do that through the software and it will retain all of that information. It also has features that make it easier to split libraries because you can create a new one and then use iPhoto Library Manager to move albums or events from one library to the other and bring all of that information over. There's also an option in it for auto-mounting a drive when the library is on an external volume. So if you forget to mount that external volume, it will handle that automatically for you. And it's just a really nice piece of software. And so if you're going to get into this point of wanting to have multiple iPhoto libraries in different locations and having your Mac access them, I would just use this software, look into it, and spend the $20. But there's a number of options for doing this stuff if you want to do it a little bit more manually and not pay for a third-party software. But I really find the convenience of using iPhoto Library Manager the way to go. So I hope that helps you out, Zach, and I'm sure it's going to help some of you as well. You know, this is another great tip if you want to have archived libraries. I use iPhoto Library Manager to kind of create these archives. Again, I'll do a smart folder, create a year's worth of photos, and then copy those into a new library. And then I can burn that library to a CD or a DVD, or I can put it on an external drive or move it over to my Drobo, which is what I actually do. And then I have a backup of that, and as well as, you know, create backups into the cloud. I typically put those on an encrypted disk image so that I'm protected. You know, when I put my data in the cloud, I don't want anybody but me getting access to that. And so all of these tips together can really help manage this stuff and get a lot of these bigger files and these older files off of our internal drives. So thanks for the question, Zach. And I guess since we're talking about photos, you know, that's something that eats up a lot of storage on our Macs. But probably the bigger one is, and the elephant in the room is, our media files, our iTunes files, our audio files, and specifically our video files. And what if you want to move those to an external and maybe set up a streaming or sharing situation? And that's exactly the question that I got from Antonio and his cousin Lorenzo. Here's Lorenzo.
Hi, Adam. My question is, I want to utilize an external hard drive to store movies, music, and photos, but to also stream them through another device, meaning through my iMac, so that I don't have all of the data, like, stored on my iMac, but it's actually stored on an external drive. What's the best solution for that? I thought it might have been a time capsule, but as I do more research, I'm not sure anymore.
Hey, Lorenzo. Yeah, I think we can help you out. And in the message, Antonio and Lorenzo also pointed out that Lorenzo has several devices, iOS devices, iPod, iPad, also a couple Macs in the household and stuff like that. So the ultimate idea here is to take his iMac and get all of his media files off the iMac onto an external drive or an external device, and then be able to share that with the other devices that are on his network and in his house. And I think we covered a little bit of how to get the iPhoto library off, but let's focus a little bit on the iTunes stuff, Lorenzo. And I think, you know, the easiest way to do this, and I think the right way to do this, because there's a lot of tricks out there, there's a lot of different things you can do, but I think the simplest one, and I always like simple solutions, and this is what I do, is to simply use your iMac, use iTunes, and use home sharing. And with iTunes, you can have your media files live on an external drive in another location. They don't have to be in your home folder, in the music folder, or in the media folder, just like you can move your iPhoto library. So setting this up is pretty straightforward. You just have to tell iTunes, you go into the preferences and tell iTunes where your media files are. So again, just like we did with iPhoto, you quit iTunes and you go to your internal drive into your home folder and you go into the music folder into iTunes, and you're going to look for your iTunes media folder, right? And that should be where, by default, all of your media files are stored. If they aren't stored in there, if you're not letting iTunes manage your files, you're going to want to go into the system preferences, you're going to want to set that up, and you're going to want to run the library consolidate options and move all those files. Let iTunes move all of your media files into that folder. You want to get them all into one place, because once they're all in one place, then we're going to move them to the external. And Apple has great instructions for doing this, but I'll just summarize it for you. So once you have it all in that place, go ahead and make sure you have your backups. I don't want to be too redundant on that. But once you have that, then you're just going to grab that whole iTunes media folder and move that over to an external drive that's connected to your iMac. So USB drive is perfect for this. It should work just fine. You could use a FireWire drive or a Thunderbolt drive if you're worried about performance or want something faster. But go ahead and move that entire folder wherever you'd like. And then you're going to launch iTunes and then go into the system preferences, go into the advanced tab, and just point at your, tell it your media file now lives on that external drive. Point to the media file on the external drive, and that should be it. Now you've got all of your media onto the external. Now, when you want to share it with the rest of the devices that are on your network, that's where home sharing comes into play. So again, on the iMac, go into iTunes, and then go under the advanced menu and turn on home sharing, and it's going to ask you to enter your Apple ID. So put in your iTunes Apple ID and password, and then you're good to go on that Mac. You're now sharing any of the media that is in that iTunes will be shared with other devices on your network, and they'll be able to see that as long as they have home sharing turned on and tied into the same Apple ID. So then what you'll want to do is on every other device, every other Mac and device on your network, you're going to want to go in and set up the home sharing. So we already said how to do it on iTunes. Go into the advanced menu, and it's under turn on home sharing. On your iOS devices, you're going to go into settings under music, and you're going to find home sharing down there at the bottom. Enter your Apple ID and credentials and enable home sharing on those devices. And then for your Apple TV, it's under the computers section, and turn on home sharing. And once you have all of these tied into the same Apple ID, they're just going to see each other on the network. So when you go into iTunes, when you go into the music app, when you go into your shared computers on your Apple TV, your iMac's library is just going to show up, and you're going to have access to all of the content that's authorized through that library on those other devices. And you can stream it over your network. You don't have to copy it. And you can just play that stuff. And that's really the simplest, easiest way to go about doing all of this. If you'd prefer to use some other solution, there are network attached storage solutions, third-party solutions that do have iTunes servers built into them, but most of that is just centered and revolves around music sharing. And when it's music, you need to have DRM-free music, and in some cases, depending upon the server product, you can only serve up MP3 files, not the AAC files that you would typically buy through iTunes. So you got to watch out for that. But I recently found out about a cool network-attached storage product or line of storage products called the Synology Disk Stations. I think Dave Hamilton over at Mac Geek Gab has one of these, and it is sort of like a Drobo. You know, you can put in multiple drives, you can expand the storage. They have different models from, you know, 2 drives to 4 drives, 8 drives, depending on how much you want to spend. But with the music server that's built in there, they have the software built into the network attached storage drive. You would not need to have your Mac turned on to be able to access the music files that are on that drive. So that Synology Disk Station would serve up those files, again, if they're DRM free. It has a web interface even, so you could go with Safari and actually access your music, see what's on there, and actually play music through Safari. It also supports AirPlay. So a cool little bit of technology, but I don't think it's as all-encompassing as just turning on home sharing. And I guess the only disadvantage of home sharing is your iMac becomes a server for all of that stuff, so it does have to be on and running iTunes to be able to have your other devices access that. But if you're like me, that's not that big a deal. The other thing you could do if you really wanted to is get an old Mac. This is an ideal job for an old Mac. If you just want to set it up as a media server, you can take an old MacBook or an old Mac Mini. You don't need a lot of horsepower. Basically, the only requirements are, one, that it has a lot of storage, and two, that it can run the latest version of iTunes. But as long as you meet those two requirements, you could set that up as a media server and use home sharing. And I think Apple's made it as easy and simple as possible. So I like to stick with the straight up Apple solution. There are other options out there. I'm sure some of you might have some suggestions of things that you're using. Please feel free to send those along, and we'll try and share them in future episodes. So I hope that helps you out, Antonio and Lorenzo. And thanks for the voicemail. All right, last thing I got for you today. This one came from Stan, who had a really frustrating thing happen. And I wanted to warn users about it in case you've ever run into this. And it also leads into a sort of Mac maintenance and performance tip. And this is something that's been around and sort of known about for a long time. It's talked about occasionally, but it only ever comes up from time to time. And it has to do with performance of your Mac and the number of things that you have on your desktop. Whether you're a person who likes a clean desktop or a messy desktop, there's a theory that if you have a messy desktop, your performance is going to suffer a little bit. But let me tell you how it manifested for Stan, because it was very interesting. He had a situation where he wanted to pull some photos down from a CrashPlan backup, and he had several albums that had hundreds of photos per album. So several hundred photos, if not thousands of photos, that he was going to pull back down from his CrashPlan backup. So I applaud you, Stan, for having CrashPlan backup and being able to get access to that. So what he did was he went in and he started the recovery from CrashPlan and started saving these to his to a folder on his Mac. And so it was running along, and he was doing some other maintenance and cleanup and wasn't really thinking about it, I don't think, and deleted the folder that CrashPlan was restoring those files to. Well, by default, what then happened, and I don't know if this is an OS feature or a CrashPlan feature, I think it's a fallback for CrashPlan. So what CrashPlan did was it suddenly didn't have the destination for those files that it was recovering. And it decided, well, then I'm just going to go ahead and throw them onto the desktop. So suddenly Stan had hundreds, if not thousands, of individual photo files on his desktop. And when that happened, his Mac started to instantly slow down, beach ball, and crash, and he couldn't do anything other than reboot the Mac. But the problem at that point was all of these files had already been restored to his desktop. So when he rebooted the Mac, same thing happened. It just started beach balling and it locked up. So why is this happening? As I said, there's this running theory in the Mac community that having a cluttered desktop can really slow your performance, resulting in beach balls and maybe even locking up your Mac in extreme cases. And to me, this has always been a little bit of a myth. I've seen many cluttered desktops that don't seem to suffer from this, but I think it has to do with potentially what the files are and the volume of those files. So in this case, we're talking about potentially thousands of files being littered on the desktop. And so the running theory, and I'm only saying theory because I couldn't find any official word from Apple that this is what's going on. So if you happen to know, if you're a developer, you know that this is what's going on, let me know. But the understanding that I have is that starting in Leopard, Apple kind of added this feature where icons on the desktop or anywhere within the operating system for that matter will generate these little special icons that show the file content. So if you drop a PDF, you kind of get a little preview of the PDF. If you drop a text file, you get a preview of that text file. And the trouble seems to be that the way that these previews are rendered or generated is that each one is in essence like having a little window open on your desktop, actual window for the document. And that's managed and rendered by OS X's Windows server. So when you put thousands of files on your desktop, they say it's like having thousands of Finder windows open all at once. And if you would try to do that on your Mac, just open, you know, 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 on up windows on your desktop, your Mac is likely going to slow down. Now, I tried to replicate this in testing on my MacBook Air. I put several hundred images on my desktop. I didn't go to thousands, and I kind of opened up Activity Monitor, and I had the Windows Server process up there, and I was kind of watching it. And I did see a significant increase while I was copying the files to the desktop, but sort of once they were copied, I really didn't see any issues. Now, I am running Mountain Lion, so I don't know if Mountain Lion maybe addresses this file issue now, or if I just need more files on my desktop. But supposedly, cluttered desktop leads to slow performance. And based on Stan's experience and the sheer number of other reports that I've seen from, again, reputable websites like Macworld, a cluttered desktop can slow down your performance. So the trick is, if you need to have a bunch of files on your desktop, you might want to throw them into folders or just leave them off the desktop altogether. And that could potentially increase your performance. So if you're having slow performance and you do have a cluttered desktop, it's at least worth a try, right? You have nothing to lose. You only will gain probably a better organized desktop and maybe even a little bit of performance on your Mac. And that's a good thing, right? I would think so. Anyway, I think that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. I want to thank you for hanging out with me. Thanks for listening. I also do want to thank all of my show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can get more information and details on their software, as well as a free trial over at circusponies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, PDF Pen for iPad, and Text Expander Touch. You can check out all of their applications as well as get free trials of their Mac apps over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle, if you need to get cash for that old iPod, that old iPhone, iPad, or even an old Mac or Android device, check out their site, gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. If you have a question, a comment, something you'd like to send me, just feedback on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails, your audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-6000. 622-4269-281-MAC-IM-9. You can leave voicemail there. You can also leave voicemail messages on Skype. My Skype address is TheMacCast, and I look forward to hearing from you. If you need show notes or links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of The MacCast, you can find those on the MacCast website. That's at MacCast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, I'm twitter.com/MacCast, or check out the MacCast Facebook page at facebook.com/TheMacCast. That's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.